into the Christ. In the same way, through the realization of Gnosis, initiates are awoken from the dream of separateness and realize their shared essential identity, symbolized by the Christ. On the cosmic level, Akamoth plays out the same initiatory journey in the Kenoma as Sophia has in the Pleroma. Christ awakens Akamoth from her spiritual sleep, which represents the inexplicable moment initiates are first touched by something beyond their normal awareness and glimpse the wider reality. Her subsequent experience of metanoia and her spiritual search represent the psychic initiation. Christ then separates Akamoth's essence from her ignorant passions, as has already happened with Sophia, which again represents the pneumatic initiation. Christ as the Logos transforms Akamoth's ignorance into the psychophysical cosmos within which the seeds of consciousness that are trapped in appearances can come to the realization of Gnosis. This allows the archetypal initiatory drama to be played out on the human level, represented by the story of Jesus, the savior of psychic initiates, and the perfect example for pneumatic initiates. The allegorical story of Jesus and Mary echoes the initiatory pattern which was first played out archetypally by Christ and Sophia in the Pleroma. The Christian myth cycle explains why Jesus has to come to our rescue and who he really is. Ptolemy teaches, the cosmos was constructed and the Saviour came to this level to save the psyche. Whether on an archetypal level, cosmic level, or human level, the whole Christian myth cycle is about redeeming the psyche, that part of consciousness which has become identified with appearances. Jesus is an image or embodiment of the archetypal Christ, whose mission he comes to fulfill by rescuing the seeds of spiritual essence lost in the cosmos of appearances. This is what Paul means when he teaches that Jesus is the Pleroma, that the Pleroma dwells in him, that in him the Pleroma of God lives, that it has pleased the Father that in him should dwell the whole Pleroma, that through gnosis of the depths of Christ's love, which is actually beyond knowing, we may ourselves attain the Pleroma of being, the Pleroma of God himself. In the end, Paul writes enthusiastically, we will all experience gnosis of the Pleroma of Christ. According to Ptolemy, Jesus becomes merged with the Christ archetype at his baptism. In the Gospel story, when Jesus is baptized, the voice of God announces, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased," and the Holy Spirit descends in the form of a dove. From the Christian myth cycle, we know that the Holy Spirit is a pseudonym of the goddess. Heraclion and Ptolemy tell us that the dove symbolizes Sophia, the mother above. The dove was a widespread symbol of the goddess in the ancient world and was adopted by Christians as a symbol of Mary. Christians of the Ophite school teach us that at his baptism, Christ and Sophia, the one enfolding the other, descended upon Jesus and he became Jesus Christ. We are all images of Christ, but Jesus represents the idea of the perfect image, a human being who embodies the universal consciousness represented by Christ and perfected psyche represented by the redeemed goddess. Hence, Paul teaches, Jesus is the power of God and Sophia of God. He comes to fulfill the mission of the Christ and Sophia, or Akamoth, which is to bring all the lost seeds of consciousness to gnosis. The cave. The Gospel story begins with Jesus being born in a cave and climaxes with him ascending from the cave. Earlier we suggested that the Christian image of the cave was derived from Plato's famous allegory of the cave in The Republic. From the Christian myth cycle, we can now clearly see that this is true. In Plato's analogy, the human predicament is compared to being imprisoned in a dark cave, where we mistake as reality the shadows on the walls, which are cast by people walking to and fro in the sunlight of the outside world. For Plato, the people in the outside world represent the archetypal ideas which structure the appearance of reality, and their shadows represent the world of appearances we inhabit. In the Christian myth cycle, this becomes the archetypes of the Pleroma manifesting as the imperfect images of the Kenoma. On the Origin of the World, a Christian text describes the goddess as a veil which divides the light of the Pleroma and the darkness of the Kenoma. Human beings exist in the darkness of the Kenoma, mistaking shadows playing on the veil for reality. The shadows are cast by the light of consciousness, illuminating the real archetypal world of the Pleroma. In Plato's analogy, the aim is to escape the cave and enter the real world of light which lies beyond. We are shackled in the cave by our identification with the body. The one who sets himself free is a true philosopher, or lover of Sophia. In Christian mythology, Jesus, the ideal initiate, is the lover of Sophia who dies to the eidolon on the cross, ascends from the cave, and enters the treasury of light, the Pleroma, or Kingdom of Heaven. In the Republic, Plato wonders what would happen to someone who, having escaped the cave and discovered the real world, returned to set his fellow prisoners free. He concludes that the prisoners would not be at all pleased to be told that they were caught up in an illusory world of shadows. If it were possible to lay hands on the men who tried to release them and lead them up, would they not kill him? This is, of course, exactly the fate the Gospel writers choose for Jesus, who, in his role as the saviour of psychic initiates, comes to set us free from imprisonment in the cave of illusion. The mob that he would redeem turns against him and has him killed. The False Father. In the cave at Jesus' birth are Mary and Joseph. In our previous analysis of the Jesus myth, we saw that Jesus' mother represents the pagan goddess of justice at the entrance of the cave of the cosmos. From Ptolemy's myth, we can now see that in Christian mythology, this figure is Mother Achamoth, sitting at the mouth of the cave of the Kenoma in the Ogdoad, from where she oversees the process of reincarnating the spiritual essences into human bodies to continue their journey of gnosis. Just below Achamoth in the seventh heaven is the Demiurge, the false god. With Mary in the birth cave is Joseph, the false father of Jesus, the Son of God, who represents the Demiurge, or craftsman. In the New Testament, Joseph is described as a craftsman. According to the Gospel of Philip, it is Joseph the craftsman who made the cross. After his crucifixion, Jesus is buried in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. The repetition of the name Joseph, as with the two Marys, is not accidental, but is designed to equate the two characters mythically. Thus, Joseph finds the cave in which Jesus will be born, makes the cross on which he will be crucified, and provides a cave to be his tomb. Jesus, the archetypal initiate, representing each one of us, is born, meets his fate, and dies in the material realm, the cave of the Kenoma, ruled by the Demiurge. But actually, we are in the cosmos, but not of it. Our real father is not the Demiurge, representing the limitations of psychophysical existence. Like Jesus, we are children of the ineffable mystery of God. Ptolemy portrays the ignorant Demiurge as having no knowledge of his mother Achamoth, Christ, or the primal parent, and so arrogantly proclaiming, "I am God, and there is no other God but me." In so doing, Ptolemy deliberately equates the Demiurge with Jehovah, the god of Jewish literalism, who famously announces the same preposterous nonsense in the book of Isaiah. By equating Jehovah with the Demiurge, the original Christians harmonized Jewish and Platonic mythology. They made Jehovah the creator of the cosmos, as he is in Jewish scripture. But they made him equivalent to Plato's figure of the Demiurge, the mediator between the one and the cosmos. For Plato, the Demiurge is not a negative figure, but the original Christians pointedly distanced themselves from Jewish literalism by deliberately portraying the Demiurge Jehovah as an ignorant deity under the higher authority of Christ and Achamoth. In the New Testament, Jesus is portrayed as seeming to be the chosen Messiah of Jehovah. The Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Luke give us two completely contradictory genealogies which trace Jesus' lineage back through Joseph to King David, so that Jesus appears to be from the line of David, as Jehovah's Messiah was expected to be. But actually, Jesus is not the son of Joseph, and he is not the Messiah of Jehovah the Demiurge. Indeed, he comes to overthrow Jehovah's tyrannical rule in the name of the true God of love. He comes to replace the laws and prescriptions of Jewish literalism with the freedom of Gnostic realization. He comes to teach that although our psyches and bodies are under the jurisdiction of the Demiurge who created them, our spiritual essence was given us by our mother Achamoth and is beyond the control of Jehovah and his entourage of cosmic powers. We are of the Pleroma. We belong to the kingdom of heaven. In the Jesus myth, the figure of Pontius Pilate also represents the Demiurge. Some Christians taught that Pilate made an image of Jesus which was crucified instead of Jesus himself. This myth encodes the teachings that it is the Demiurge, the craftsman, who creates Jesus' body, the eidolon or image, which is what is actually crucified on the cross. Through the death of the eidolon, Jesus defeats the Demiurge and his forces, which have temporarily imprisoned him within the cave of the cosmos. Paul teaches, on that cross, he discarded the cosmic powers and authorities like a garment. Paul also reminds initiates who have symbolically died and resurrected with the figure of Jesus. Did you not die with Christ and pass beyond the reach of the elemental powers of the cosmos? The Cross of Light. The Christian myth cycle transforms our understanding of Jesus' crucifixion, revealing it to be a symbolic reflection of archetypal events. The cross, sometimes known as the Cross of Light, is the name of the boundary between the Pleroma and Kenoma. Ptolemy calls the cross Redeemer and Emancipator. It is the creation of the cross which exiles Achamoth into the Kenoma, and so saves Sophia from being consumed by her ignorance and fear. It is the cross which the Christ reaches across to redeem Achamoth. In the Jesus myth, it is through dying on the cross that Jesus frees himself, and therefore all who follow his example, from the cave of the cosmos. Thus, first on the archetypal level, then on the cosmic level, and finally on the human level, the cross is the means of redemption in the Christian myth cycle. Jesus suspended on a cross echoes the archetypal Christ suspended on the cross of light. Christ is the embodiment of the Pleroma. As such, he is securely on one side of the cross, which divides the Pleroma from the Kenoma. But through the ignorant passions of Sophia, some part of consciousness, and therefore of Christ, has become trapped on the other side of the cross. Christ is therefore suspended on the cross of light in the Pleroma as the Christ, and in the Kenoma as the lost seeds of spiritual essence. This mythic motif is based on Plato, who taught that the Son of God is suspended crosswise in the universe. Christ, representing universal consciousness, embodies all the archetypes of the Pleroma united through Gnosis, and is therefore a symbol of the whole made up of many parts. Christ is the one consciousness which appears as the many separate seeds of consciousness which are trapped in ignorance and seeking liberation through living a human life. The oneness of the Christ is fragmented when it passes beyond the cross of light into the Kenoma. Drawing on imagery from the myth of the pagan godman Osiris and his Greek alter ego Dionysus, the Book of the Logos imagines this as the Christ being dismembered into many limbs. In the Jesus myth, the Father sacrifices his Son on the cross. If taken literally, this is a grotesque notion. In the context of the whole Christian myth cycle, however, we can understand this motif as an archetypal event. The Father, mystery, sacrifices his Son, consciousness, through crucifixion or dismemberment, so that we, the many seeds of consciousness, can experience life. Our existence as individuals is bought at the price of the Christ's crucifixion. Our deaths as separate individuals through the realization of Gnosis are his resurrection. Christ is crucified on the cross of light, that divides the pleroma and the kenoma, the one essence and the multiplicity of appearances. Jesus is crucified to reunite the two. The way down and the way back are through the cross. The seamless garment. The image of the Christ divided on the cross, representing the one consciousness of God, divided into multiplicity, is symbolically alluded to in the Jesus myth, when the soldiers who have crucified Jesus divide up and cast lots for his clothing. The Gospel of Luke narrates, Jesus said, Father, forgive them, they don't know what they are doing. And they parted his garment and cast lots. Jesus' garment represents psyche, which clothes consciousness. We also find this image in the Hymn of the Pearl. In this allegorical Christian tale, at the end of his quest, the hero puts on a garment of light, representing perfected psyche, and declares, The garment seems to me like a mirror of myself. In it I see all in all. I see that we are distinctly two, yet one. I see gnosis. In this passage, psyche is represented both by the mirror in which consciousness sees itself and by the garment that it wears. The perfect mirror reflects the light perfectly. The perfect garment is one with its wearer. Understood macrocosmically, Jesus on the cross represents the consciousness of God and his garment represents the psyche of God. According to the Gospel of John, Jesus' garment is seamless, which represents the pristine oneness of universal psyche. In this gospel, it is the garment rather than Jesus that is divided up. This is perhaps a better allegory than that found in the Book of the Logos, because although it appears that consciousness is divided, it is actually forever one. It is psyche which is divided, not consciousness. Consciousness appears to be a multiplicity because it witnesses many separate flows of experience, many psyches. It is significant that the soldiers cast lots for the pieces of Jesus' garment. In the Republic, Plato portrays disembodied psyches awaiting reincarnation, throwing lots to see which of the lives available will be their next life. In the Jesus myth, this becomes the soldiers who don't know what they are doing. Psyches without gnosis at the foot of the cross, below the cross of light in the Ogdoad from where the mother sends back psyches into human incarnation, throwing lots for which will be their particular fragment of Jesus' seamless garment, which particular part of universal psyche or experience will be theirs to live out. Remembering Christ. The Acts of John gives us more fascinating insights into the meaning of the cross of light and its relationship with Jesus' cross at Golgotha. It relates that John could not bear to watch Jesus being crucified, so he fled to a cave on the Mount of Olives. The image of a cave with olive trees growing outside is, once again, an allusion to the Ogdoad, the place of the goddess at the mouth of the cave of the cosmos, outside which grows the olive tree of wisdom. Suddenly, darkness comes over the earth, and Jesus appears to John as light. He teaches him that, although the people of Jerusalem believe they are watching Jesus being crucified, they are only watching the eidolon or image of Christ. The archetypal Christ is the light of the pleroma, which is illuminating the underworld cave to enlighten John. Jesus shows John the cross of light and explains, This cross of light is sometimes called Logos by me for your sakes, sometimes consciousness, sometimes Jesus, sometimes Christ, sometimes a door, sometimes bread, sometimes seed, sometimes resurrection, sometimes son, sometimes father, sometimes spirit, sometimes life, sometimes faith, sometimes grace. But as to what it is in itself, it is the marking off and delimitation. This is not that wooden cross which you will see when you go down from here, nor am I the man who is on the cross. I am who you now cannot see, but only hear. I was taken to be what I am not. I am not what for many others I was. What I am is known to me and no one else. In the cross of light, John sees many people who all share one form, whilst around the cross stand a great crowd of separate individuals. The individuals around the cross are the spiritually dead, the seeds of consciousness still lost in the ignorance of the kenoma. Those who are in the cross represent the spiritually resurrected. They have one form because they have seen through the illusion of separateness and realized their essential oneness with all that is. They have died to the eidolon and been reborn as the Christ. They are the limbs of the dismembered Christ that have been reunited. Jesus explains, "Not every limb of him who came down has been gathered together." But he assures John that when the time comes, those who presently don't hear will become as you are, and will no longer be what they are not, but exist above the cosmos as I do. When all those around the cross recognize their true nature, then the Christ will be reunified. We are in the process of remembering Christ. But until all the lost seeds of consciousness spiritually awaken and recognize their essential shared identity, the Christ will not be completely reunified. Jesus tells John, "As long as some do not call themselves mine, I am not what I am." The Ankh. The Christian myth cycle suggests that the original source of the Christian image of the cross is the ubiquitous Egyptian cross, the Ankh. This ancient symbol was so important to Christians that they tooled it into the leather cover of one of the collections of Gospels found at Nag Hammadi. The basic Ankh is a circle above a T cross. The crosses that were used for crucifixions were T-shaped, and in Jewish mythology, Moses lifts up a serpent on a T cross in the desert, which was understood as a pre-echo of the image of Jesus on the cross. For these reasons, the early Christians thought of the Christian cross as T-shaped. The Ankh, therefore, would have been seen as the cross of Jesus below a circle. The circle is a symbol of wholeness and nothingness. It represents the archetypal potentiality of the Pleroma. The Ankh shows the Pleroma as delineated by the horizontal axis of the cross, just as it is in Christian mythology. Below the circle, the kenoma is cut in two by the descending vertical axis of the cross, representing the mystery made manifest through duality. The Ankh is expressing the idea of syzygy, the one as two. Mirrors were constructed in the shape of an Ankh, with the cross as the handle and the circle as the mirror. The circle and the cross represent that which is whole and that which is divided, the essence and the appearances, the mystery and the manifest, the Pleroma and the Kenoma. Understanding the relationship between the poles of this fundamental duality is the key to the realization of gnosis. And what is that relationship? It is one of reflection. The image is a reflection of the archetype. The appearances are how the essence looks to itself. Wanting self-knowledge, the one becomes two. The mystery becomes the viewer and the mirror. It creates a concept of what it is. It reflects on itself. From these two, thinker and thought, comes the cosmos. The mystical marriage. In the Christian myth cycle, Sophia is the last archetype of the Pleroma, and Achamoth inhabits the Ogdoad at the edge of the cave of the Kenoma. The two aspects of the goddess exist either side of the cross of light. When the Christ's aeon mission is complete, and all the lost seeds of spiritual essence are retrieved, the two aspects of the goddess will be made one. In the Jesus story, the Virgin Mary and the redeemed prostitute Mary Magdalene, representing Sophia and Achamoth, are both pictured at the foot of the cross on which Jesus is crucified. In the Gospel of the Beloved Disciple, aka Gospel of John, from the cross Jesus unites the two Marys. To the Virgin Mary he says, "Mother, this is your child." And to Mary Magdalene he says, "There is your mother." From that hour on, the two Marys share the same house. Like Demeter and Persephone at the end of the Eleusinian myth, the two aspects of the goddess are finally reunited, with which Jesus announces, "It is finished," and dies. In the Christian myth cycle, the uniting of Sophia with Achamoth precipitates the mystical marriage of Jesus and the goddess in the bridal chamber of the Pleroma. In the New Testament, this is symbolized by the tearing of the veil of the Jerusalem temple at the moment that Jesus dies on the cross. The veil covered the secret inner sanctum of the temple, the Holy of Holies, which represents the bridal chamber, the Pleroma. The Gospel of Philip explains, "The bridal chamber is hidden. It is the Holy of Holies. The veil at first conceals how God arranged things to be, but when the veil is rent, the things inside are revealed." As we explored previously, the veil represents the goddess. When Jesus dies, the temple veil is torn, the hymen is rent, the two are made one, the mystical marriage is consummated. This sexual imagery connecting the Holy of Holies in the temple with the bridal chamber was not a Christian innovation. A Jewish Talmudic tradition states, "When Israel used to make the pilgrimage, the priests would roll up the veil between the temple and Holy of Holies and show them two cherubim entwined there, one with the other, and say, 'Behold, your love for God is like the love of male and female.'" The Hebrew word for knowledge is da'at, which also means sexual union. Gnosis truly is knowledge in the biblical sense. It is the coming together of the opposites in such intimacy that they become one. It is God and goddess making love and so restoring the primal unity of the mystery. It is the one being two becoming one. Summary. The Christian myth cycle is an initiation allegory which gives us the same basic initiation motif on three levels. On the archetypal level, Sophia is redeemed by the Christ. On the cosmic level, Achamoth is redeemed by the Christ as the Logos. On the human level, Mary Magdalene is redeemed by Jesus, the embodiment of the Christ Logos. Jesus embodies universal consciousness and purified psyche, represented by Christ and the goddess, both of which enter him at his baptism. He comes to fulfill their mission by freeing the seeds of consciousness trapped in ignorance. The cave of the cosmos, into which Jesus is born, and from which he ascends, is the Kenoma. The Virgin Mary represents Mother Achamoth sitting at the entrance of the cave of the Kenoma. Jesus' false father, Joseph, represents the demiurge or craftsman, the false god. The cross on which Jesus is crucified is an image of the archetypal cross of light, which divides the Pleroma and the Kenoma. The Virgin Mary and Mary Magdalene at the foot of the cross on which Jesus is crucified are images of Sophia and Achamoth at the foot of the archetypal cross of light, across which the Christ is suspended. From the cross, Jesus unites the two Marys as mother and daughter. This represents the reunion of Sophia and Achamoth. The uniting of the two aspects of the goddess precipitates the mystical marriage, which is the fulfillment of Jesus' mission. In the Jesus myth, this is symbolized by the veil of the temple being torn in two, representing the tearing of the hymen. When we grasp the vast scope of the whole Christian myth cycle, the idea of taking the Jesus story as a biography appears ridiculous and facile. It reduces the mythologically complex and philosophically sophisticated Christian vision of life to a question of blind belief in the historicity of a one-off supernatural event. Actually, Christianity is ultimately not concerned with Jesus at all. He is an image of the Christ, and the Christ is an image of the mystery. And the mystery is what we are. Christianity is about what we are. It is about the mystery of consciousness. We have explored the mythic significance of Jesus and the two goddesses, Sophia and Achamoth. There is one other important mythological figure in the Christian myth cycle. That is the demiurge, the villain of Christian mythology, who was known as the God of the Blind. Let's now explore some of the extraordinary teachings encoded in the story of how the demiurge creates the cosmos, which includes powerful insights into the perennial philosophical problems of free will and fate, and the origins of evil. Chapter 10. The God of the Blind. Evil is thought to abound on earth, but if you could see the plan of Providence, you would not think there was evil anywhere. Boethius, The Consolations of Philosophy. The demiurge represents the ego. In the same way that the ego is an eidolon or image of our true identity as consciousness, Akimoth creates the demiurge as an image of the aeon consciousness. The original Christians equate the demiurge with Jehovah, portrayed by the Old Testament as jealous, angry, vindictive, self-obsessed, a perfect symbol for the ego. Hence, modern Jungian psychologists have named the neurosis of egotistical self-inflation the Jehovah complex. The demiurge has an inflated sense of his own importance because he has no knowledge of his mother Akimoth or Christ or the primal parent. In the same way, the ego has a ridiculously puffed-up idea about its significance because it has no knowledge of the greater psyche of which it is a part, its essential nature as consciousness, or the great mystery of which it is an expression. The demiurge doesn't know that Akimoth has put seeds of spiritual essence into his human creations. He is lost in his own fantasies about why he has created the cosmos and has no understanding of the true purpose of creation, which is to free the consciousness trapped in ignorance. Likewise, the ego is lost in its own silly personal fantasies of what life is about. It has no understanding of the real purpose of life, which is for us to awaken to our true essence. The original Christians used the figure of the demiurge to provide a mythological answer to the important philosophical question of how an imperfect cosmos, full of suffering, pain, injustice, cruelty and other evils, can arise from a source of perfect love and goodness. The explanation given in the Christian myth cycle is that the primal parent is not the creator of the cosmos, the demiurge is, and the imperfections of the cosmos reflect his imperfections. In the same way, understood allegorically, this myth explains how human beings can be so heartless and small-minded when their eternal essence is the infinite love of God. The Christian answer is that our natural goodness is eclipsed by an impostor, the ego. Despite his inadequacies, however, the demiurge is not evil. He is created from Akimoth's metanoia, her change of heart or repentance. Although he seems to be the problem, he is, albeit unknowingly, part of the solution. It is through the cosmos, created by the demiurge, that the seeds of consciousness lost in ignorance can be redeemed. In the same way, on the human level, the ego, the idea of ourselves as a separate individual, is a necessary stepping stone in our evolution towards gnosis. We don't undermine a child's ego, but encourage the development of a self-image. Human beings beginning the process of spiritual maturation need the ego which shapes their world, just as Akimoth needs the demiurge who shapes the cosmos. Yet ultimately, we must transcend the ego to discover our true essence as consciousness, which is represented in Ptolemy's myth by the liberated seeds transcending the demiurge and uniting with the Christ. The demiurge, like the ego, is ignorant and foolish rather than evil, but through his foolishness he creates the forces of evil. In Ptolemy's myth, when the demiurge fashions the cosmos, he creates the devil and his wicked angels from the mother's grief and confusion. The demiurge, ego, gives form to the nebulous negative emotions of Akimoth, psyche, and in so doing creates the devil, the shadow or negative self. The devil or shadow is the demiurge or ego's bungled attempt to cope with difficult unresolved emotions. This view of evil as arising from psychological disorder is so remarkably modern that it is clear why Carl Jung regarded the Christian Gnostics as proto-psychologists. On a superficial reading of the Christian myth cycle, then, it looks as if the demiurge is responsible for the evils of the cosmos we inhabit. The allegorical message seems to be that it is the ego, or the shadow self it creates, which causes human beings to act badly. On the psychic level of understanding, this is indeed the message. But on the pneumatic level, the myth cycle encodes deeper and more confronting teachings, which undermine the idea of personal volition and therefore the concept of responsibility altogether. Free will and fate. Ptolemy uses the figure of the demiurge to give some important allegorical teachings about free will. When the demiurge creates the cosmos, he thinks he is acting from his own volition, but actually he is an unknowing instrument of a higher power. The demiurge thought he was creating the cosmos himself, but in reality it was Achamoth through him. Achamoth, or psyche, acts through the demiurge, or ego. Yet Achamoth is not the source of her intentions and actions, any more than her wayward son is the source of his. The creation of the cosmos is Christ's plan to redeem the seeds of consciousness trapped in ignorance. It is Christ, representing the universal consciousness of God, who is actually the source of the actions which issue through Achamoth and the demiurge. Allegorically, this teaches that whilst the ego, like the demiurge, imagines itself to be a godlike creator who freely wills its own thoughts and actions, it is universal consciousness which is the ultimate source of every appearance within every psyche, including every action apparently performed by every individual ego. The ego is not the source of anything. It is part of the phenomena being witnessed by consciousness. The ego is the idea of ourselves as an autonomous agent, acting separately from the whole. But if all is one, then everything is happening as one. What we think of as our actions arise spontaneously from the mystery. Because they pass through psyche as intentional thoughts, we say, "I intended to do that." But although our actions may appear to be the result of our free will, actually, they issue from the will of God. On the Christian way, the psychic initiation is about progressively perfecting the eidolon, the self-image, by understanding the self as an integral part of the whole. The pneumatic initiation is about transcending the illusion of personal autonomy altogether and being consciousness passively witnessing the unfolding oneness, which includes all of our thoughts and actions. When we do this, it is not that we discover we are just programmed automata with no free will. It is that there is no us to be free or otherwise. There is the mystery witnessing the oneness. The Christian sage Monoimos teaches that God is the center of the circle of self, from which everything issues, and advises, "Stop searching for God outside yourself. Look for him within. Examine who says, 'My God, my consciousness, my understanding, my psyche, my body.' Investigate the source of your experience of sorrow and joy, love and hate, waking up though you don't will it, and sleeping though you don't will it, and falling in love though you don't will it. If you closely investigate these things, you will find him in yourself, the unity in variety, like a central point. Thus you will find in yourself a way out of yourself." If we follow Monoimus' advice and look within, the idea of ourselves as autonomous agents becomes obviously absurd. If we simply pay attention to the coming and going of thoughts, it soon becomes apparent that they rise up from the darkness of the unconscious mystery, regardless of our will. We cannot stop them, and it is meaningless to say we cause our thoughts. We can only consider ourselves the cause if we have first thought, "I will think so and so." But this is infinitely regressive, as we are not the cause of that thought. And as our actions issue from our thoughts, if our thoughts are not our own, then our actions are not our own either. The truth is, we witness our thoughts and the actions which issue from them. Thoughts emanate from we know not where. The psyche is a virgin mother because it never sees what causes it to give birth to the thoughts and images which arise within it. Plotinus teaches, just as the spoken word is an echo of the thought in the psyche, so thought in the psyche is itself an echo from elsewhere. Philo teaches that we are egotistical and godless if, as separate individuals, we think ourselves equal to God by believing we are acting when in truth we are passively experiencing. What we think and do is the fruition of what God has sowed and planted in the psyche, and it is impious for us to say we do the planting. Paul proclaims, "The life I now live is not my life, but the life which Christ lives in me." In the Gospel of John, Jesus teaches, "I am not myself the source of the words I speak to you. It is the Father who dwells in me, doing his own work." The Christian sage Bardesanes teaches that the three theories about volition, that our lives are completely determined, that we are subjected to the rule of fate, and that we are free, are all partly true and partly false. As a physical body, we are all governed equally by the laws of nature. As a psyche, we are all governed differently by our justly deserved fate, which decrees our various experiences of life. As consciousness, we are each as free as we let ourselves be. Consciousness is utterly free, and so are we, therefore, to the degree that we realize our true nature. We are determined, fated, and free, relative to the different levels of our identity. But ultimately, all issues from the will of God. Bardesanes teaches, nature has to do with the body, fate with the psyche, freedom with consciousness. None is absolute. God alone is the absolute. Missing the mark. Although everything is happening as one, the fact that our actions occur via the ego is significant. For the original Christians, that creation happens via the demiurge explains how an imperfect world can arise from a perfect source. In the same way, that actions happen via the ego explains how it is that God can seem to act imperfectly through us. When we act, the perfect goodness of our authentic nature becomes distorted by the ego, so that natural qualities manifest as selfish vices. Plotinus explains, the natural urge to live degenerates into ugly passions. Courage becomes ferocity or cowardice. The natural yearning for the good becomes the pursuit of the semblance of beauty. Power at its lowest produces wickedness, for wickedness is a misguided desire to know consciousness. The Greek word hamartia, traditionally translated sin, is a term originally used in archery and means simply to miss the mark. For the original Christians, to sin is not to do evil, with all its absolute Catholic connotations, but to mess up, to fail to express our true nature and instead do something stupid. Our true nature is the good. When the ego gets in the way, the good's perfect idea becomes our sinful action. What we do misses the intended mark. For the original Christians, the imperfections of the cosmos are due to the foolish demiurge, the cosmic ego. In the same way, our imperfections are due to our ego. Because of the demiurge, the perfect archetypal cosmos manifests as the flawed cosmos of appearances, evolving from imperfection to perfection. Because of the personal ego, God's perfect idea of a human being, the archetypal man, manifests as us, flawed human beings on a journey of evolution to manifest our perfect essence. So the Christian myth cycle teaches that, from the absolute point of view, no one is responsible for anything, and from the relative point of view, it is ignorance or error, in the form of egotism, which is the source of all our problems. The cause of the terrible things which human beings do is not some force of absolute evil which they willingly serve, a diabolical idea which Christian literalists would have us believe. No, it is simply lack of gnosis which causes human beings to act badly. Bad people are aspects of the oneness who are convinced they are the separate ego and so end up hurting themselves and others in a misguided attempt to serve their own selfish interests. When we are aware of the oneness, guilt and blame are irrelevant. When we know the good, we no longer see evil and evildoers, just ignorant people who are, as Plotinus puts it, like immature children, as yet unaware of the goodness of their essential nature and the unity of all things. We are all one, So when some lost soul expresses their ignorance of the oneness by acting badly towards others, it is like some demented fool hitting themselves with their own fist. When the apparent evildoer is then vengefully vilified by other self-righteous lost souls, it is like the same fool roundly condemning their fist for its evil nature and punishing themselves with a blow from their other fist. The inevitability of evil. If everything is happening by God's will, we cannot ultimately blame the demiurge for the imperfections of creation. God, and God alone, must be responsible for all the evident evils of the world. Yet the Gnostics teach that the essence and origin of all is the good. Dionysius writes, "The most important of God's names is the good." In the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus, like Plato, proclaims, "The one alone is good." But how can this be true? The secret teachings of the original Christians do not give an explanation for the individual evils which each one of us confronts in our own particular lives. From stubbing one's toe to the horrors of the Holocaust, suffering cannot simply be explained away by philosophy. But Gnosticism can and does account for the inevitability of evil, demonstrating its relative nature and its positive role in the greater goodness of things. The Gnostic answer to the question, why is there evil, is that without it, there would be nothing at all. Evil is an unavoidable byproduct of the process of origination itself. Consciousness is only possible with the duality of subject and object. Implicit in this primal duality is every other duality, including good and evil. The one is the good. When it arises as the two, it inevitably becomes the good and the bad. Actually, it would be more accurate to say that the one is absolutely beyond description, but it appears to us, living in the duality of good and bad, as the good. As Plotinus teaches, it is the good not for itself, but for others. The undivided state is neither good nor bad, but from the divided state, it appears as the good. The one realizes its nature as subjective consciousness when it objectifies part of itself as psyche. In the same way, it realizes its nature as the good when it manifests as the syzygy good and bad. The inevitability of evil is implicit in the first stirrings of consciousness when it separates itself from itself as objectified psyche. The Christian myth cycle narrates how this error is amplified by Sophia in the Pleroma and Achamoth in the Kenoma. Finally, imperfection is made manifest as concrete reality by the demiurge. The root of all evil is duality, separation, objectification. The essence of all goodness is the urge to resolve duality into unity, which we experience as love. According to the creation myth taught by the Pythagoreans, in the beginning a cosmic egg representing the oneness of potentiality split in two halves, representing the primal duality. What arose from the egg was eros, or love. When the one divides itself, the impulse that arises is to reunite, and that impulse towards unification is love. Without evil, separation, there would be no love, reunion. Good and evil arise together. The Gospel of Philip teaches light and darkness, life and death, good and evil, are pairs of mutually dependent siblings who only exist in relationship with each other. The letters of Clement describe good and evil as the right and left hands of God. A Mandean text teaches light and darkness are brothers emanating from the one mystery. The Ebionite school of Christianity portrays the devil, the embodiment of evil, as the brother of Christ, the embodiment of the good. The devil is the divider who entraps us in the illusion of separateness. Christ is the uniter who frees us to realize the essential oneness. The devil is not an irredeemable embodiment of absolute evil, however, because there is no absolute evil. The only absolute is the good. Evil exists relative to the absolute good. Being is absolutely good. Experience is relatively good and bad. For the one, everything is absolutely good. For the parts, everything is relatively good or bad. Plotinus teaches, what is evil for an individual is a good thing in the universal system. And what appears to be relatively good for one part of the whole is relatively bad for another. As the philosopher Antiphon jokes darkly, incontinence is bad for the incontinent, but good for the doctors. Death is bad for the dying, but good for the undertakers. The original Christians symbolized the cosmos by a snake eating its own tail, which is good for the head and bad for the tail. The kenoma appears to be both good and bad, yet it is essentially good because it is the journey towards the good. What seems like evil has a positive role to play in the process of evolution. There is good and bad, but that is good. Bad experiences can be important turning points on the journey of awakening. Often the spiritual quest is suffering-driven. We are trying to get away from a situation we don't want. Suffering and joy are the stick and carrot which goad and cajole us along the path of life. In the Consolations of Philosophy, Sophia teaches, all fortune, whether pleasant or unpleasant, is meant either to reward and encourage the good or punish and correct the bad. Children see their parents as alternately good and bad, depending on whether they are being praised or censured by them. But in reality, caring parents are always being good to their children, regardless of whether they temporarily appear to be harsh or soft. The original Christians portray the source of life as a father-mother because, in the same way, life is parenting us to spiritual maturity. And as most of us know from personal experience, it is often life's reprimands that benefit us the most. Sophia explains, what I want to say is such a paradox that I am hardly able to put it into words. For bad fortune is often of more use to someone than good fortune. Good fortune always seems to bring happiness, but deceives you with her smiles, whereas bad fortune is always truthful, because by changing, she shows her true fickleness. Good fortune deceives, but bad fortune enlightens. In the world of duality, sooner or later, everything must turn into its opposite. Day becomes night. Living things die. Good fortune turns to bad fortune. Good fortune deceives us into investing our happiness in necessarily transitory appearances, which must ultimately disappoint. What appears to be bad fortune, on the other hand, can inspire us to seek out a deeper source of joy by discovering the perpetual bliss of our permanent essence. What appears bad to us is actually tough love. The apparent evils of life are the good in disguise. Summary. The Christian myth cycle is an initiation allegory in which Christ represents consciousness. Achamoth represents psyche, and the foolish, arrogant demiurge represents the ego. In the cosmos, evil manifests through the demiurge, who creates the devil from the mother's grief and confusion. In the individual psyche, evil manifests through the ego, which creates the shadow or negative self from unresolved negative emotions. The demiurge believes himself to be creating the cosmos of his own free will, but it is actually Achamoth working through him and Christ acting through her. In the same way, the ego mistakenly believes itself to be an autonomous agent, but actually everything is happening as the unfolding oneness, expressing the will of God. An imperfect world arises from the perfect source because creation happens via the demiurge. In the same way, when we act, the perfect goodness of our authentic nature becomes distorted by the ego, so that natural qualities manifest as selfish vices, making us sin or miss the mark. God is the good. Evil is inherent in the process of origination, however, because when the one arises as the two, it inevitably manifests as the syzygy good and bad. The root of all evil is duality or separation. Goodness is the urge to resolve duality into unity, which we experience as love. Apparent evil has an ultimately positive role in the evolution of the cosmos of appearances. The purpose of all the extraordinary teachings encoded by the original Christians in their mythology is to guide initiates to the realization of Gnosis. Having explored the hidden allegorical meaning of the myth of Sophia, the myth of Jesus, and the overall Christian myth cycle, let's finally attempt to articulate, insofar as language allows us, the essence of Gnosis. Chapter 11. The Mystical Marriage. Through Gnosis we are purified of diversity and experience the vision of unity. Those who have realized Gnosis know the source and the destination. They have set themselves free by waking up from the stupor in which they lived and become themselves again. Valentinus, The Gospel of Truth. What is Gnosis? This is a hard question to answer, because to realize Gnosis is to embrace paradox. Our logical mind may find this impossible, but life itself has no problem in being paradoxical regardless. Life is the ineffable made manifest, the one appearing to be many, the permanent present perpetually changing. Here the impossible union of spheres of existence is actual, as T.S. Eliot writes. Life is paradoxical by its very nature, and so are we. As a body, we are in the cosmos, but as consciousness, the cosmos is in us. Gnosis is looking in two directions at once, as Plotinus explains, and simultaneously being aware of our essential identity as the mystery and our appearance as a person. It is a mystical marriage in which the two aspects of our syzygistic nature commune as one. For, as Jesus teaches in the Gospel of Thomas, when you see the two as one, so that the male and the female are united, then you will enter the kingdom. Our present problem is that we are intent upon the fragment and severed from the whole, as Plotinus puts it. We are aware of being a person, but not of being the mystery. The purpose of the Christian way is to bring us to an awareness of the one, the good, God, mystery, however we choose to describe the indescribable. The psychic initiation teaches us how to live as a human being with compassion for all beings, because we are all parts of the one. The pneumatic initiation teaches us to transcend the separate self and become aware that essentially we are the one. Let's examine in more detail these two initiations and how they combine to lead us to the realization of Gnosis. The psychic initiation. The psychic initiation takes us on a journey from being a selfish individual to becoming a conscious expression of the oneness of God, who naturally expresses love for all. It teaches us to live well in the world by manifesting our essential nature, which is the good. We presently appear to be partly bad because we mistakenly identify with the eidolon, the separate self. In so doing, we set ourselves apart from the whole and become a self-serving somebody competing to achieve what is good for us, not cooperating to fulfill what is good for all. As Plato writes, attachment to self is the constant source of misdeeds in every one of us. Plotinus explains, evil has its source in self-will. For Christian literalists, we are born in sin and need reforming by being made to follow a strict code of shoulds and should-nots as laid down by the religious authorities and apparently approved by God himself. Should we fail to live up to God's expectations, we could well find ourselves spending the whole of eternity suffering horrendous punishments. The approach of the Christian Gnostics is the complete opposite of this. Ptolemy explains, our essential nature can't possibly be damned no matter what we do. Consciousness cannot be corrupted regardless of the behaviour it has to pass its time in the company of. A piece of gold does not lose its beauty when it is put into filth, but keeps its own nature, since the filth can't harm the gold. What leads one to the Pleroma is not behaviour, but the seed that was sent here as an infant and grows to maturity in this place. We don't get into the Pleroma, the kingdom of heaven, as a reward for obeying the rules, but by recognizing that this is already the eternal home of our essential self. We are spiritual not by behavior but by nature, and will be preserved no matter what. We are saved not because of how we act, but by being what we are. For Gnostics, therefore, becoming good is not about obeying some written moral code, but about purifying ourselves of the egotism which obscures our natural goodness. To do this, we must become conscious of our covert selfish motivations, which are rooted in our identification with the ego. The Gospel of Philip explains, "As long as the root of evil is hidden, it is strong, but if it becomes known, it dissolves. If we ignore it, it takes root in us and brings forth its fruit in the heart. It takes us captive, so that we do the things we don't want to do, and don't do the things we want to do. It exerts this power because we have not recognized it." For Gnostics, it is not what we do, but why we do it that counts. Certain actions are not intrinsically good and others intrinsically bad. It is the motivation which makes an action good or bad. According to Irenaeus, the Gnostics teach, "Actions are not good or bad in themselves, but only in accordance with human conventions." Paul writes, "As a Christian, I am absolutely convinced that nothing is impure in itself." This challenges us not to blindly go along with how everyone else thinks we should live, but to find the good within and decide for ourselves what is right and what is wrong. We must test everything and retain the good, as Paul says. Traditional ethical laws and religious customs may be helpful guidelines for beginners on the path, but as we spiritually mature, they become increasingly irrelevant. The more we awaken, the more we naturally exhibit our essential goodness, and the need to follow any sort of ethical code is completely superseded. According to Clement of Alexandria, outward observances cease to have any value for those whose whole being is brought into an abiding harmony with that which is eternal. They rest in the contemplation of God, which is and will be their unfailing blessedness. As our realization of gnosis deepens, we no longer abstain from evil because of fear of punishment or do good from hope of promised reward.